Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
In our efforts to comprehend the systematic dispossession of indigenous peoples in settler colonies, such as the United States, Canada, or Australia, the notion that invasion is a structure, not merely an event, first articulated by Patrick Wolfe, has become something of a maxim for critical theorists. Part of this structure, as Patrick Wolfe described it, was a logic of elimination. After all, the settler must eliminate the native in order to secure her claim to the native's territory. But whom does the settler-native binary exclude? And what do we fail to understand about how settler colonialism functions as a result? Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Asian American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nancy, one of your hosts, and I have the great privilege today of addressing these questions with Aiko Day, who is Associate Professor of English and Critical Social Thought at Mount Holyoke College, as well as a faculty member in the Five College Asian Pacific American Studies program. Hi, Aiko.
Hi, Nancy. It's nice to talk to you.
It's great to have you here. So we're here today to talk about Aiko's new book, Alien Capital, Asian Racialization and the Logic of Settler Colonial Capitalism, which was published in 2016 by Duke University Press. In Alien Capital, Aiko does no less than re-theorize the logic of settler colonialism, suggesting that, in fact, our starting point for understanding its structure should not be a settler-native binary, but rather a dynamic triangulation between settler, native, and alien populations. But before we get into the nitty-gritty of Aiko's dazzling book, I'd just like to ask you, what led you to this project?
So I think that, like many projects, you know, mine came out of just, you know, my own experience. I'm from Canada, and I moved to the United States for graduate school. And originally, I was going to develop a project that was kind of looking at Asian Canadian literature and poetry and just generally cultural production. But as I was sort of trying to make sense of my own, you know, positionality in the United States, I got really interested in just trying to really understand Asian racialization beyond the comparative touchstones of anti-Black racism in the U.S. And that's a sort of theory where, you know, the racial content or the racial ontology of Asian Americans is kind of sort of understood to exist between Black and white, where the racializations could be kind of seen as like a byproduct or something that's related to a foundational anti-Blackness. And so as someone from Canada and British Columbia in particular, I had a hard time sort of seeing myself within that kind of approach to Asian racialization. And part of that was, again, like anecdotal. You know, when I was younger and growing up, I was really shaped by the struggles of First Nations peoples in British Columbia, especially like the blockade movement. Just as I am now, very profoundly shaped by anti-Black violence in the U.S. So, you know, by kind of reflecting on this distinction, I'm really not trying to minimize or deny the violence of anti-Black racism in Canada. But that sort of awareness of this sort of distinction kind of just pushed me to sort of think about how the interplay of race and indigeneity, you know, deserve more exploration, particularly because they kind of unfold in slightly different ways in Canada and the U.S. So then from there, I kind of looked at, like, so if Canada and the U.S. kind of, they have different sort of racial formations, The absence of, you know, plantation slavery in Canada is one of the distinctions. The sort of heightened kind of political significance of First Nations struggles is also another way in which I would distinguish that, you know, settler colonialism in Canada and the United States. But one of the things that was eerily similar in both places was anti-Asian policy. So if you look at the history of anti-Asian immigration policy from the 19th century, it really unfolds in virtual lockstep. So that just led me to the question, well, if Canada and the U.S. have kind of divergent or sort of distinctive racial and indigenous formations, what accounts then for the eerie parallels in anti-Asian immigration policy and just Asian policy in general? So that was kind of the origins of the exploration. And instead of thinking about it in terms of a foundational anti-Blackness that could account for those similarities, I wanted to sort of think about something else that the U.S. and Canada shared, and that is the sort of history of British settler colonialism or white settler colonialism. And so I was interested in reframing the question of Asian racialization through land and settler colonialism rather than, or I mean, it's kind of in addition to anti-Blackness, but these aren't sort of canceling each other out, but it was sort of to prioritize a settler colonial mode of production and trying to understand, using that as a framework to understand anti-Blackness and anti-Asian racialization and a whole host of questions related to race and indigeneity.
That's fascinating. And it's interesting the ways in which the Canadian and American comparative framework that you show actually emphasizes that we need to understand Asian racialization on its own terms, in addition to Black racialization, right? The fact that the process of Black racialization in Canada is not identical to the one in America. And yet, as you say, there's the process of Asian racialization in the two countries is eerily similar. One thing that struck me is, you know, on the one hand, that you said that in the book that Asian racialization has been subject to this kind of analogy making with regard to anti-Blackness. But then at the same time, the introduction to your book bears this title, The New Jews.
Right.
And it makes this really striking analogy between anti-Semitic tropes on the one hand and Asian racialization on the other, right? And then at the same time, you of course insist that Asian racialization is actually distinct from the processes that produced anti-Semitism. So can you talk a little bit about what is alluring and what is actually productive about this new Jew analogy? And then what might be hidden from view with that analogy?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the new Jews analogy, which is something that's probably a little bit more prevalent in the US than it is in Canada. The way that I've heard it used is to kind of signal, you know, the increasing affluence and assimilation of Asian North Americans. I've heard it in kind of benign ways, meaning like it's kind of a compliment to Asian Americans that they have achieved this level of kind of incorporation that's following the trajectory of Jewish assimilation and incorporation. And so this in some ways follows, you know, the work of Matthew Fye Jacobson, and who, you know, teaches us that, you know, Jewish Americans kind of evolved from a kind of non-Anglo-Saxon social identity in the 19th century, and then gradually was incorporated into a kind of Caucasian or white social position by the mid-20th century. So that's sort of the benign, way in which that analogy has been used. But of course, you know, the negative side of the analogy is that, you know, there actually has been a long history of conflating Asians and Jews outside of North America. And I looked to the work of Jonathan Friedman, whose research looked at the way that, like Jews, Chinese merchants who were active through East and South Asia also faced similar forms of resentment, economic resentment and discrimination. And so you, with both of those figures of the Jew and the Asian, and particularly the Chinese, you have expressions of a kind of destructive industriousness, a kind of greed, and even evil that that actually has kind of grown, that surrounds those two figures. And they are also popular cultural representations of that kind of figure, which include, you know, Georges de Maurier's creation of like the Svengali figure in the 19th century, as well as Sax Rohmer's invention of Fu Manchu. And so in both cases, you know, you have these two characters who are perverse, evil geniuses who, you know, aspire to world domination. So what's distinctive about the Jewish, the new Jews analogy is that unlike a theory of, I guess, of racial inferiority that we often associate with racism, there's a kind of destructive superior, like, you know, domination that's associated with this. So I started to think about how an economic modality of modern anti-Semitism might also help to explain Asian racialization in a North American settler colonial context. And so for that, I drew on Moish Pistone's discussion of, he has a sort of a whole re-theorization of the Holocaust, in which he looks at the way in which Jews who had historically been segregated in financial sectors of the economy, of the European economy, how they became, through the process of modern anti-Semitism and in a period of crisis, how they became to personify actual processes internal to finance capitalism and this association with the abstract negative dimensions of capitalism. So I looked at that and thought that's really interesting because a lot of the tropes associated with Jews it allowed me to sort of adapt that framework and think about how the Asian subject in North America similarly represented or personified abstract processes of value formation, but not because they were segregated in financial sectors or interest-bearing, you know, institutions, but rather by looking at the way they were associated with a certain form of destructive labor.
That's so interesting. And so I think that in the book, and correct me if I'm wrong, you term this sort of abstraction of Asian bodies and Asian labor as representative of capitalism as part of what you call this romantic anti-capitalism. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about what romantic anti-capitalism is in the context of your book and how it relates to Marxist theories of the fetish. What's really going on there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you've really honed in on, like, I think the book's main argument, which is my argument is that that romantic anti-capitalism is like a key ideology of settler colonialism. And so part of this means that what romantic anti-capitalism is basically a misunderstanding or misperception of capitalism as a kind of opposition between the concrete natural world, like the touchable world, let's say, like the world of commodities and things that we can see and touch and sort of their sensory. So it sees that as kind of opposed to the abstract dimension of our world, which include, you know, invisible circuits of capital, like value. And so if we read, you know, Marx's Capital, this is a misperception because the concrete and the abstract are actually in working constantly in dialectical relation. But in moments of crisis, we see how, you know, we tend to privilege, or what romantic anti-capitalism does is it privileges the sensory and organic world over the things that are sort of invisible. And I can kind of, I mean, the example that I always use to sort of describe this in more popular culture ways is actually the film Into the Wild, which is it's actually a true story of this guy, Christmas McCandless, who, you know, he really hated his upper middle class lifestyle. And he ran away and he tried to, you know, he was on this quest to live in nature in the Alaskan wilderness. And so basically what I understand from this story is that his animosity towards capitalist modernity was like so intense that he basically, you know, he burned his cash and destroyed his material objects. But it was kind of a misperception a misperception of capitalism, because he sort of idealized the wilderness as sort of outside of capitalism. And it's a kind of a binary view of nature as non-capitalist and capitalism as anti-natural, right? So, you know, in his case, which is kind of sad because he actually died, but, you know, him living alone in wilderness is it's not anti-capitalist. It will do nothing to overthrow capitalism. But we can see, though, in the example is how romantic anti-capitalism has the capacity to shape our idealized notions of purity and impurity, what is authentic and inauthentic, and who is natural or unnatural. And I was just recently teaching a section on one of my classes on Vincent Chin, and you know, he was killed because he was sort of a representation of these abstract, you know, economic threat associated with Japanese auto manufacturing. So we can see again how this abstract threat can kind of be personified by Asians, and so that's sort of the way in which I'm thinking about romantic anti-capitalism. And on the other side of it, to connect this to sort of settler colonialism, you know, there's also this romantic attachment to indigeneity, right? So we see in a lot of the dominant aesthetic production of white settler association or attachment to land, it's often, you know, through this kind of indigenizing function to associate, to naturalize whiteness in the landscape. So I'm interested in that as well.
Wow. So to zoom out a bit for our audience, the picture you've drawn for us so far, and I think it's really striking that you say it's in a way a misunderstanding or a misperception or conflation in a sense, is a white settler romantic anti-capitalism that on the one hand makes the white subject seem native and seem natural and concrete, and on the other hand associates the yellow or the Asian subject, more generally I should say, with the threatening foreign abstract economism of capitalism. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit, and I guess this goes into chapter one a bit, how it comes to be that the Asian subject gets aligned with that threatening foreign abstract labor. I mean, you talk persuasively about the way that certain conceptions of time and also of deviant sex play into that. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm happy to. Yeah, it's so a lot of that first in trying to think about how Asians kind of get associated with this destructive realm of capitalism, I begin my exploration with thinking about 19th century Chinese labor and how that became progressively associated with a destructive kind of a destructive efficiency. And if I could just back up one, just a step, I should also say that, you know, just going back to the point about the new Jews analogy, one of the other points that I'm trying to make, which follows the work of Colleen Lai and others, is to sort of argue that there's no break between a kind of yellow peril-ism of the 19th and early 20th centuries and the new Jews, that they're kind of two sides of the same coin, or to say, to put it in other terms, that the model minority stereotype, which we, you know, many of my students think is a positive stereotype, and yellow peril, that they're actually very much, they're part of a similar continuum that actually just sees economic efficiency and particularly labor efficiency as the basis for exclusion in a kind of yellow peril moment or assimilation in a kind of model minority moment. So that's one of that's sort of the continuum that I'm trying to chart over, you know, over the period that begins in the 19th century and into the contemporary moment. So going to the point about time and thinking about labor time, I look at the way in which there's a kind of excessive efficiency associated with Chinese railroad labor. And I look at how that excessive efficiency that comes into conflict with white labor reinforces the sort of temporal and quantitative dimensions of Chinese labor as a threat to the qualitative dimensions of white labor. And so over time, that kind of temporal and quantitative dimension actually is reinforced and expanded through this notion of Chinese perversity, through the development of these homosocial spaces, of Chinese bachelor communities, et cetera. So we see this sort of fusion of the quantitative and temporal dimensions of Chinese labor as being destructive, and then later on becoming associated with the destructive, perverse kind of elements of Chinese sexuality and Chinese like masculinity, or a perverse kind of form of Chinese sexuality. So that's one of the ways in which I sort of explore the features, I guess, the gendered and sexualized features of the destructive abstractions associated with Chinese labor time and its threat on a kind of qualitative, qualitatively good, I guess, notion of white labor. And I look at that through various cultural productions.
So it's really interesting because speaking of those cultural productions, even as your entire book is theorizing the ways in which Asians are racialized, I think almost all of the sources that you use are actually cultural productions by Asian North Americans, Asian Canadians or Asian Americans themselves. And I was wondering if in particular in the work of Maxine, I think in this chapter you'll get Maxine Hong Kingston, and I forget the name of the other artist, Richard Fung. If you could talk about the ways in which in their works they're speaking back to these notions of time. What do you mean by history too in this book?
History too is so thank you for that question. That's a great question. So history too is my way of looking or approaching Asian North American cultural production and the way that it responds or sort of in dialogue with, in each chapter I have, it's kind of a dialogue between an Asian American cultural producer and an Asian Canadian cultural producer kind of responding to this thread that connects the US and Canadian settler colonial formations. So that's part of the structure of each chapter. So history too is a concept that I developed or that I use from the work of Dipesh Chakrabarty that thinks about the way in which we can think about time in different ways. And so a lot of the, in this chapter on the railroad, I think about the ways in which they respond, their representations of time point to a different kind of futurity. So I'm thinking about both how the works disidentify with a sort of settler colonial representation of time or construction of time, because in the 19th century, time becomes sort of consolidated with the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad. So how does it both expose and sort of and highlight the exclusions represented in or that are embedded in those notions of time, capitalist temporality, and then how do they point to alternative futures that are, you know, allow us maybe that have a kind of utopian impulse. There was another question. Okay, I think that I'll just end that. I'll end the question there.
Sure. And I was wondering then, so this is how the alien is being, the idea of the alien other is being produced. But can you talk a little bit about the construction of the indigenous? Because it seems on the one hand that you're pointing to the romanticization of indigenous native bodies, obviously at their expense, but also at the indigenization of white bodies and they're embedding them in nature. Can you talk a little bit about how that happens or how that has happened in the American Canadian contexts?
Yes. So this is something that I look at, I think, in another chapter where I examine landscapes landscapes in Canada and the U.S. that are construct or they're landscapes that are aesthetic landscapes, so like painterly, like artistic constructions of lands of the land that were produced in like the 1920s and 30s, which in both Canada and the U.S. is a time of, you know, heightened xenophobia. We have all these immigration laws that are being passed in the 1920s. And so I'm interested in the way in which people like the Group of Seven in Canada, Emily Carr, construct whiteness and or indigenize whiteness in a particular way. And so I look at the way in which the landscape is in some ways personified as a kind of white figure that's controlling the sort of unruly social forces from below. I also look at Ansel Adams and Gutzon Borglum, who created Mount Rushmore, again, to sort of look at the way in which whiteness and white dominion over the land is really strongly associated and sort of constructed in relation to a particular view of landscape. So, of course, it's about romanticizing indigeneity and indigenizing whiteness in opposition to a kind of a racialized threat that in this case is represented by the Chinese, but also other Asian ethnic groups. One of the examples I think that kind of bears this out, a more contemporary example, is actually the film Cowboys and Aliens, which is not a film that many people have seen, but it's a film where actually you see the alignment of cowboys and Native people against this alien, you know, this alien threat, which you could sort of see as a personification or is a representation of Asians. But again, this idea that white settler or kind of white settler identity is heavily invested in this sort of alignment with indigeneity, even as it is, you know, committing has genocidal policies against that indigenous community, real indigenous communities. In a kind of imaginative realm, indigeneity is kind of a anchor for a kind of white settler claim to a kind of ownership of the land.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. I think there are actually a lot of striking similarities there between the ways in which the idea that the threatening indigenous, you know, or alien other, even as it is, I mean, historically been the reverse, right? It's been indigenous, dispossessed, and so on and so forth. It is very parallel to the ways in which, you know, there's implicit representations of the black other as threatening, you know, when in fact it was sort of slave catchers who were chasing. There's a lot that's been written about that, the role of race in these sort of science fiction fantasy narratives. So we've talked a lot about representations, but of course these representations of labor, of indigeneity, of land, and so on, bear very concretely on racialized bodies. I mean, put bluntly, racial representations have consequences, right? Racialization has consequences beyond just, of course, racialization itself. So can we talk a bit about Japanese internment and how you treat Japanese internment in the book? I mean, as you said, very strikingly, there is a continuum between the notion of Asian peril and the notion of model minority. And I see Japanese internment as being this event between these two tropes or representations that people often see as something of a conundrum and can't make sense of in our perhaps idealized notions of or narratives of American history. How do you conceptualize of Japanese internment in the book?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, for the longest time, I struggled especially with the representation of Japanese Canadian internment that's depicted in Joy Kagawa's Obasan. And so Japanese internment in Canada and the U.S., I should note, was quite different in the sense that in Canada, Japanese Canadians weren't allowed to return to the West Coast until 1949. And so there was a whole dispersal policy after the war. So many Japanese Canadians were actually sent further east into the prairies. And this is a policy that was actually discussed in the U.S., but actually never materialized. But But one of the interesting parallels in Japanese Canadian and Japanese American internment was the kind of association with nativeness, and particularly the way in which Japanese Americans were, in the case of Poston, were, you know, sent to a native reservation. And then in Canada, the discourse, actually in both Canada and the US, the discourse surrounding Japanese internees in when they were relocated was that they were there was a worry that they would become dependent on the government like Native Americans. And they were actually many ways treated like Native Americans. And the War Relocation Authority in the US, you know, had similar personnel, you know, from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So there was kind of this interesting conflation that was happening between Japanese and Indigenous and Native communities in both Canada and the U.S. And so I was trying to kind of make sense of that. And so for the chapter on Japanese, relocation, I looked to Colleen Lai's work. And one of the ways that she explores the sort of heightened racism around Japanese, the sort of Japanese enemy aliens in the lead up to relocation, was how they were associated with a kind of monopoly capitalism. I mean, prior to Japanese internment, there were alien land laws, there were all these other sort of restrictions on, Asian property ownership and things like that. And so she asks a host of questions about, you know, the association of Japanese with kind of a form of like they're taking over the agricultural industry and things like that. So I basically build on her analysis and argue that Asians or Japanese become associated with a form of kind of having a control over relative surplus value. And relative surplus value is the value that's produced above and beyond surplus value. And it's usually associated with a kind of technological innovation. And it produces a temporary extra profit for the producer. So every capitalist is looking for a relative surplus value. And so this idea that Japanese become progressively associated with a kind of mechanized innovation is one of the ways in which we see how they are displacing kind of, again, our threatening, white labor, white agricultural hold on particular industries. So it fed the perception that Japanese labor kind of monopolized the creation of relative surplus value and therefore had to be, taken out or like expelled from that area. And this is also, again, building on the work that I established in the introduction around how Asians and through history have been associated with these different modalities of a destructive dimension of capitalism. And so in this chapter, I look at this idea that they're associated with a kind of industrial capitalism that, particularly a technological innovation that is monopolizing the creation of relative surplus value. But then I also later on acknowledging that there is this conflation that happens once Japanese internees are removed and are in various locations, either in British Columbia or in other parts of Canada, the interior of Canada. I also look at Poston, which was a place which had the Colorado River. Sorry, I'm totally blanking on the. There's a kind of a conglomerate of different Indigenous nations at Poston, and how their conflation with Native identities functions to sort of renovate so that association with nativeness removes the association with the destructive abstraction. And so they become kind of more associated with the pliable surplus labor force. And I argue that makes way for the model minority thesis, which, as we know, emerges very shortly after Japanese relocation. I mean, it's like within the span of 15 years that we have the model minority thesis and the argument that Japanese Americans and Japanese Canadians are the most similar culturally, et cetera, to white Americans. So So we see that that kind of, in some ways, destigmatizes Japanese labor, or kind of constructs a new modality in relation to surplus labor.
Right. And again, here, I think that the comparison between Canada and America, in a way, internationalizing the phenomenon of internment, which at least obviously in the American academic context, we tend to see as a solely American or chiefly American phenomenon, really helps clarify some of those processes of conflation, as you say. So bringing it to today, as you point out, you know, Asians are racialized now as either, I mean, depending on whom we're talking about, as either poor migrant labor or supposedly wealthy, flexible, competent model citizens. Can you talk a bit about that period after internment, that the role that neoliberalism has played in constructing such abstractions since the 1960s?
So kind of beginning where I just ended, this idea that the kind of conflation or identification with Native identities kind of neutralizes this association with a natural value, and then reconstitutes Japanese Americans and Japanese Canadians as a kind of ideal surplus labor force, and leads kind of gives way to, or at least clears a space for the emergence of the model minority thesis. So that takes us to the 60s. And again, as I mentioned before, immigration policy in Canada, the U.S. really emerges, I mean, as it relates to Asian migration and immigration policy related to Asian groups, you know, really does kind of unfold in lockstep. So the liberalization, or as I put it, kind of neoliberalization of immigration law in 1965 in this country is followed, you know, is very parallel to the 1967 immigration law in Canada. And one of my main argument in that chapter is kind of based on, I think, where I grew up in Vancouver Island, but particularly looking at Vancouver as a place where there was all this heightened racism around foreign investment, Chinese foreign investment in places like Vancouver, and that there was this perception that they were buying up all this land or buying all these houses and turning them into monster houses. And so I was interested in the rhetoric around foreign investment and how it related to the border and immigration policy. So for me, what I think that neoliberal immigration policy achieved was kind of like a fulfillment of a settler logic, in the sense that it kind of in some ways further entrenches this notion of an abstraction, a kind of the foreign capital associated with Asian citizens is, again, it's entrenching an alignment of Asians with the kind of an abstract kind of financial dimension of alien capital. And so, you know, the sort of resentment of wealthy Chinese investor migrants, which we certainly see in, you know, not just in Vancouver, but probably in lots of different places in throughout North America, and actually throughout the Americas, I would say. So that becomes kind of an expression of this. And meanwhile, these are expressions that were really encouraged by foreign policy. So in Canada, for instance, there was a multiculturalism means business kind of policy, explicit policy. So this is about attracting foreign investment from Asia. And this is sort of the repercussion of that. Meanwhile, the sort of denigration of poor or low-skilled migrants kind of has remained. I mean, in the 19th century, the passage of the Chinese Exclusion Act, the passage of the Canadian Chinese head tax, and later Chinese Immigration Act in 1923. I mean, all of those policies were meant to deter poor, low-skilled migrants. And so that has remained consistent, because 1967 and 1965 immigration policies explicitly in Canada, and have become more of a reflection of Canadian immigration policy. They favor a point system, like they favor a highly skilled, you know, as Ling Chi Wong puts it, techno coolies. and so that there still is the same similar perception of low skilled Asian laborers as being some kind of destructive threat through their labor, the threat to white labor that they represent, or the threat to white citizenship that they represent. I mean, that's sort of remained consistent. So that remains untouched, but plus it's sort of aggravated by this notion that Asian foreign capital is also this destructive, is also this kind of destructive threat associated with wealthy Asian investors.
So one thing I was struck by, and just to go back to the beginning a bit, is that you've mapped out this distinct process of Asian racialization, and on the one hand, it has to do with the sort of perceived threat of specific, you know, let's say Japanese or Chinese labor. And yet there's also this notion of Asian racialization, right? That something about the visual culture, for example, I as a Korean might be abstracted in the same way as a Japanese subject in the street, right? Just to put it very, very colloquially. And I was wondering, I mean, how that process happens, how it comes to be. Is this yet another level of conflation? In addition to the abstraction of capital?
Well, that's a great question. And I think that the way that I try to respond to it is through, again, continues with thinking about the role of the border and thinking about how immigration policy functions as a form of kind of global Jim Crow or a global site of like segregation on a world scale. And so thinking about the development of, or the history of capitalism in North America, you know, one of the arguments I make is that the racialization of Asians is also more abstract, meaning in a slightly different way than I meant. I mean, in other parts of the argument, but it's more abstract in the sense that it's less fixed. It's less mutable, or sorry, I should say immutable. So when Asian migration comes into North America, it's at a moment in the history of capitalism that requires a much more flexible labor force. And so as a result, you know, there's this idea that Asians are kind of less racial than African Americans or indigenous populations whose racial essence is kind of expressed as the relative power of their blood to contaminate in the sense of, in the case of African Americans, or to sort of erase a population and if we think about indigenous populations. And so so it's interesting that in many ways there Asians don't have, because of the border, as a racial signifier, the idea that there's some kind of indelible transferable attributes that are associated with Asianness, you know, that whole modality of racialization that we might associate with Blackness is really less necessary as a strategy of containment, because unlike emancipated slaves, you know, Asians could and were excluded from the nation state through immigration policy. So it wasn't as much of a requirement to sort of fix these kinds of racial notions to the body, because their entire body could be excluded. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think this framework of the global Jim Crow really helps zoom us out a little bit and not be so limited to the national framework and thinking about how these processes of racialization happen. And I guess I wonder, I thought a lot about in this book, about complicity, right? We're talking a lot about the ways in which subjects are racialized. But then it also struck me that, you know, different racialized subjects can be interested in very different kinds of political projects, right? And I thought that this was particularly clear in the case of Israel, right? That on the one hand, there is the racialization of Jews. And of course, that serves as a kind of analogical function with regard to Asian and racialization in your book, right? That they've undergone one process of racialization. And yet on the other hand, and of course, this is like very prevalent in Palestine studies and Middle East studies more generally, it's very clear that there are reasons to consider Israel itself as a settler colony. So I was wondering how you understand Israel as a typical settler colony or as a meaningfully exceptional one?
Yes, that's a great question. And it's not a question that I take up with any level of development, you know, in my book, but certainly I think a lot of people, the thinking and the development of settler colonial studies is really considered the question of Israel. And for me, the work of Brenna Bandar, her recent book is called The Colonial Lives of Property, and the subtitle is Law, Land, and Racial Regimes of Ownership, which is a fantastic examination, kind of comparative examination of settler colonies and like logic of property and ownership in Israel, South Australia, British Columbia, and also in relation to British property laws that were enacted in Ireland. So one of the things that I learned from her book is that on one hand, Israel is a typical settler colony in the way that it, through Zionism, it imports particular ideologies of improvement and use from British colonial law. And so there's a real emphasis in Zionism on particular, very specific modes of cultivation in order to assert a property right in land. And this is really consistent with property law that I'm familiar with, and particularly in North America, where, you know, there's this idea that, you know, if you improve the land, then it's sort of the basis of property, you're an ownership, right? So indigenous people occupy the land, whereas settlers own it. And so this ideology of improvement and use is really central and really consistent across these different settler colonies. The other thing that's really interesting that she looks at is that when thinking about anti-Semitism is that particularly in Europe, anti-Semitism was really a lot of the negative kind of racist the racism was directed at the perceived nomadism and against migratory peoples. And so this kind of creates an interesting connection between anti-Semitism or between Jewish and Native peoples who are perceived as not belonging to a fixed location. And so the way that it kind of evolved in Europe was that Jews were perceived because as migratory peoples that weren't attached to a specific, you know, allotment of land, that they could avoid tax, you know, and that, and so in many ways, what Zionism does or political Zionism does is it resolves that tension by creating an attachment to land through cultivation. It's really gendered. So land improvement is kind of perceived as a mode of redemption for Jewish peoples, and it restores the sort of masculinity of the settler against a kind of feminization that's perceived or is associated with the sort of Jewish diasporic figure. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But I think that it's also important to kind of note the distinction that unlike other settler colonies, where in which there is absolutely a colonial profit motive that existed throughout North America as well as Australia, especially when you see the development of these corporations that establish these property laws or enact kind of property and through cultivation and through surveys and a whole bunch of like forms of mapping. What's distinct at least in Bandar's book, she talks about how, you know, the theological dimension of Zionism is definitely distinct, and there isn't really that kind of same profit motivation of a settler colonialism that exists in Israel. Those are some of the points that I drew from her examination of Israel.
That's really interesting. And it's certainly, I mean, to fill in the other half of it, I think that certainly aligns with at least my understanding of the ways in which the Arab Palestinian was racialized in that context, right? The migratory Bedouin Arab. So I was wondering how, I mean, Alien Capital, I think the audience should know with no exaggeration, is an astonishing, you know, new theorization of settler colonialism. I was wondering how it's been received in the few years since it's come out.
I think that it's been well received. I think, I mean, it, it, it's I feel like I'm in between two. I mean, I'm sort of both, or how do I say this? I feel like I'm kind of an Asian Americanist thinking about this question of settler colonialism, which is distinct from some of the theorizations of, I guess, Asian settler colonialism in Hawaii and other places, and particularly because I'm trying to sort of move out of a binary framework of settler colonialism. And so in that desire to do that, I have been really profoundly impacted, and, you know, I feel like I'm in conversation with a lot of people working in Black studies, thinking about other ways to sort of think about Blackness in relation to white settler colonialism, conquest, and things like that. So I'm in between, I feel like, you know, different discourses surrounding Asian American studies, Native and Indigenous studies, as well as Black studies. So in all of those, the response has been, I think, it's been positive. I think there's still tensions, just in my observation of how these discourses are unfolding, that there's, you know, there have been tensions around thinking about anti-Blackness and or slavery and colonialism and how we can understand their intersection. And so I've actually been really, you know, I've thrown myself into reading other works like Manu Karuka's, you know, he has a kind of Marxist-Leninist book on railroad imperialism and shareholder whiteness in his book, Empire's Tracks. I mean, I mentioned Brenda Bandar's book, The Colonial Lives of Property, and then Robert Nichols' recent book, Theft is Property. It also is a really excellent way of kind of thinking through the relationality of slavery and colonialism, and also thinking about the role of just property. I feel like that's a through line that a lot of the discussions, which is something that kind of is in the periphery of my book. I mean, thinking about Cheryl Harris's notion of whiteness as property, but that comes to the fore in thinking about both the expression of, like, the way in which property is enacted in land, but also notions, thinking about notions of self-possession, right? And the body as something that is owned, or, you know, what is the status of self-possession and liberal conceptions of self-possession. So those have all been really interesting ways that I have thought about connections with my book.
That's really striking. Actually, that reminds me of one of my favorite parts of the book, but perhaps also one of the more controversial ones, is when you talk about the position of African slaves and African Americans within the settler colonial triangulation that you set up. And you say that actually we should understand slaves as migrants and not as this sort of indigenous natives in this triangulation. And of course, you know, you say that in no way implies an equivalence, you know, between the heterogeneous experiences of African slaves and Asian migrants and their descendants. But could you talk a little bit more about that, about why it actually helps us understand anti-Blackness more to perceive or to conceive of the Black body as part of that migrant point in the triangle?
Right. Well, I try to, I don't know if I emphasize migration specifically, but I do emphasize the idea of being alien. So the whole point of the sort of orientation of the whole book is to sort of think about indigenous land. So if everything is oriented around that, then you have white settlers, but I argue that you have racialized aliens. So people who are not indigenous, but they're not non-white, non-indigenous people. So I think about African slaves in the U.S. as being kind of the original or sort of first aliens to the United States, and which is very distinct from obviously the later arrival of Asian aliens. But to sort of think about it, the triangulation in those terms, so like white settler, indigenous, and racialized alien.
And can you tell us a little bit about your future projects?
Yes, I'm thinking about at the moment a few different things, and I'm not sure if they all go together really clearly yet. So I'm looking forward to my upcoming sabbatical. but I am interested in thinking through exploring the idea of nuclear colonialism. And the origins of this new sort of set of questions that I have emerges just from doing a little bit of research on the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. And actually my family, my grandmother and my uncle and my whole family on my mother's side is from Hiroshima and lost people through the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. So I was interested in, you know, exploring some of that, that history. And it turns out that the uranium that was sourced and used in the atomic bombing was sourced from the Northwest Territories in Canada. And also the Belgian Congo in Africa. So I was kind of interested in this intimacy of, you know, three continents, I guess, between like the Belgian Congo, Northwest Territories, and how, and then that the uranium that went into the bomb was tested in New Mexico and then, you know, detonated over Hiroshima. So sort of thinking about the logistics of that, of the transport of uranium. So that's one of the questions that I have. And then the other is to sort of think about settler colonialism in African nations. And in particular, just thinking about the way in which, at least in Patrick Wolf's theorization, or the sort of dominant conceptualizations of settler colonialism often exclude African nations, African settler colonies. So I've been thinking about looking at extractive economies, settler colonies in Africa, to examine how the connections and maybe disconnections in the phenomenon of wastelanding in places like that, you know, produce minerals for the global north, but similar processes that exist in the Northwest Territories in Canada, as well as in places like New Mexico and other parts where there you have the same kinds of extraction, sort of places that are, there's extraction and also dumping that happens in the same place.
Wow, Aiko, I think it is with no exaggeration, I can say that we're very excited for those upcoming book projects. Thank you so much for coming on here today.
Thank you so much for having me.